Good afternoon, everybody. It's really great to be here. And like many others, Jacob is one of my true heroes. So I'm going to be the light entertainment for the day, and I hope you'll find this amusing. So my title has two parts to it. So one of them was by the numbers, and the second part is about the human experiment. I want to, before I even begin, just explain to you what I mean by those two ideas. So with respect to the numbers, if we were to think about a semiconductor company or people that design chips or computers or cars or planes or bridges, the engineers that do that depend upon a reservoir of well-curated numbers that describe the thermal conductivity, the electrical conductivity, the mechanical strength, and so on. And that's codified in books like the Handbook of Chemistry and Physics. And in a way, the question that I've been asking, especially with Ron Milo, shown here on the left, who's the guy who really started the BioNumbers website, which I hope many of you have had a look at before, and then with my friends shown over there, with whom I've written this book, Physical Biology of the Cell, we've been very interested in the idea of biological numeracy. What can we say about the numbers in biology, and to what extent can we trust them? And so I'm gonna try and comment on that a little bit. So in addition to commenting on measurements, there's also a sense in which we want to understand the numbers. And this makes me think of what is affectionately known as Fermi problems. So that's a picture of Enrico Fermi, one of the great physicists of the 20th century. And he was known to be able to get a numerical answer to more or less any question in physics within 15 minutes. Number of piano tuners in Chicago, how much heat loss from your home if you forget to put on your storm windows in the winter, how much energy is spent by the thinking of ants when they construct a colony, just endless questions like that. And I really admire that, and I think that that's a prism through which to view data. So I think I'll skip this. So that was the by the numbers part. As far as the human experiment part goes, and I guess I also want to join others in making a disclaimer, this is definitely out of my comfort zone, although at this point I've led 15 field trips of people around the world to the Galapagos, New Zealand, Indonesia, and various places like that. And part of what I can report back to you is constant scenes like you see in the lower right. That's the Cocos Islands out in the middle of the Indian Ocean. I was just in the Indian Ocean on a boat about 3 months ago, and we had a kilometer-long river of plastic flowing by us out in the middle of the ocean. I was in Alaska a few weeks ago, plastic all over the beaches. So at any rate, the human experiment has to do with this idea that we as humans are doing stuff to planet Earth, and I think that that's probably obvious to everyone. And here's a couple of my favorite articles that I think make this point. The one on the left from Stephen Palumbi, where he talks about humans as the world's greatest evolutionary force. And then this wonderful article by Estes and many other famous people on trophic downgrading of planet Earth. And I'll come back to that in a little bit. So here's the plan of the talk. What I want to do is I want to try and present to you a feeling for the numbers in biology. And I've always been inspired by Barbara McClintock and this wonderful biography of her by Evelyn Fox Keller. And she's basically, the title of the book is channeling McClintock. I think it's fascinating, probably many of you know this, but Barbara McClintock could look at the chromosomes in a microscope and she would be able to tell what the corn would look like. She would know, as an American, you know, we hang mace on our doors at Thanksgiving and they have kind of rainbow colors, and she could be able to tell you that just by looking at the chromosomes. And I love these comments from her. So she didn't delegate her work to students. She said she could write the autobiography of every plant she worked with. Over and over again, she tells us one must have the time to look, the patience to hear what the material has to say to you. Above all, one must have a feeling for the organism. So what it means to have a feeling for the organism can be stated very simply. I want to be able to know what sets the scale of a given thing. And let me give you an example, which is one that I love, which is what sets the height of mountains. So it's actually very easy to make an estimate of the heights of mountains on any planet. And here's the way it goes. You figure out how much a column of rock weighs, and then you simply ask, how tall must that column be before it reaches the yield strength of the rock at the bottom? Basically, what you're talking about is crushing. There's a crushing force. And it's very easy to estimate depending on the strength of gravity. In the context of biology, you know, there's all sorts of things, and it was really cool to hear the previous talk, because I've wondered often about things like the rate of diversification. So what sets the timescale of evolution? The reason I show the picture of Le Petit Prince is that if you lived on his planet, then evolution would be quite different because selection would be very much less important than drift because of the small population size. So at any rate, if I can't answer these questions, I don't know what I'm talking about. Let's see, I show this just because I wanted to call attention to Robert Payne, who I'm sure many of you know about. He's the guy who in the 60s on the coast of Washington basically removed Peisaster ocreatus, which is a sea star, from a tide pool, and then basically over time he looked at the diversity of that ecosystem and led to this idea of trophic cascades. And so part of where I'm heading, I'm still not to my talk, this is all by way of introduction, is we really want to have time series for biomass and also anthropomass. Okay, so what I'm going to do, this is really weird, is I'm going to basically give you guys an exam. I have 15 questions, and that's my talk. That's all I'm going to do, is just give you 15 questions, and then I'll comment on the answer to each one. And as a suggestion, I would love it if maybe today or tomorrow you would take 5 minutes to take this exam, which is called the Gapminder exam. It comes from Hans Rosling. And basically, the reason I show Jennifer Lippincott-Schwartz here, she's got a chimp, she's with her daughter, is that chimps do better on this exam than humans. And I've done this test many, many times. I've done it in India, I've done it in Korea, I've done it in France, I've done it all over the place. I did it in Marseille when I taught to Thomas' group. And humans are really bad at this. And I'm going to give you the biological Gapminder. So that's my plan. So this is all things that I've done with Ron Milo and also his amazing student Yinan Baran. Last year we had this paper on PNAS on the biomass distribution on Earth, and the bottom line is that this is something I've had a lot of fun with Helen. Okay, so here's my first question. What length of book would DNA polymerase, including proofreading, copy without an error? So choice number one is A, the Bible. Choice number B is the Encyclopedia Britannica. For the younger people in the room, you probably don't know what an encyclopedia is, but you know, we A, B, C, D, E, you have a book for each one. People like Isaac Asimov would read the whole thing when they were kids, or English Wikipedia. I don't know if we should, I don't know, do people want to vote? How many of you think it's A? B? C? Okay, so the answer is Wikipedia. And I think this is best illustrated by this wonderful article by Tanya Baker. So she wants us to imagine that DNA has this diameter. So think of DNA about the diameter of a sewer pipe. And if that's the case, then the polymerase, DNA polymerase, will be about the size of a FedEx truck. It will be traveling at 500 kilometers per hour. It will make a delivery on each side of the street every 10 centimeters. It will complete its daily journey in 40 minutes. And it will make a mistake in delivering a package once every 3 years. That's the fidelity of DNA copying. So, you know, you see that in these rates. Over here, 10 to the minus 10 is sort of the typical rate per base pair per genome replication, and transcription and translation are more error prone. And what I wanted to say is you can make a simple estimate of the likelihood of an error. So what I want you to imagine is that we have two species of tRNA, the right one and the wrong one, or you know, hydrophobic and polar or whatever. And we can just compute simply the difference in energy of binding the proper codon, anticodon pair versus the incorrect one. And what you'll find is that that model leads to a gross error in the predicted error rates. And you know, probably many of you know that in the early 70s, both Jacques Ninot and John Hopfield simultaneously had this idea of kinetic proofreading. So that's my first example, just to give you a sense of what I mean by the data, the number, the by the numbers part, that's the 10 to the minus 10th rates. And then I also did the Fermi problem for you, which is a simple estimate of error rates using standard thermodynamics. And you find that thermodynamics is not enough. Okay, here's my second question. I'm going to do four questions on molecular and cell biology, then I'm going to turn to ecology, but I just want to give you a sense of what these kinds of questions are. How many sugar transporters are needed to make a bacterium? How many of you think it's 100? 1,000? 10,000? Thanks for voting, I appreciate it. Or 100,000? Okay, so let me run you past this one a little, rather quickly. So a typical bacterium has about a 1 micron cubed volume. If I assume it has the same density of water, that means it's 10 to the minus 12 grams. If I say that 30% of that is dry mass, which is probably reasonable, then half of that dry mass is carbon, I know that the mass of carbon is 15 over 100 times 10 to the minus 12 grams, and I simply divide by 12 grams per mole, and I will find that it's around 10 to the ninth. As you can see in part three, number of carbons is 5 times 10 to the ninth carbons per cell, and that means you need 10 to the ninth sugars. The cell cycle is 1,000 seconds. That means 1 million sugars need to be brought on board every second for a growing bacterium, 1 million. A typical transport rate is around 100 per second, and this is just a sanity check. Now, there's beautiful proteomic data, and the red dots tell you the number of sugar transporters, glucose transporters in particular, for E. coli, and you can see it's around 5,000. And I just showed you, by just sort of pure thought, that it needs to be about 5,000, because if I'm going to take 1 million sugars per second, and each transporter does 200 transports per second, I need roughly 5,000. Okay, this is a fun one. Which is bigger, protein or the mRNA that codes for it? Quick response, though. I don't want you to think for too long. Okay, so the first time I thought of it, I just thought, well, you know, blueprints are usually smaller than the thing that they blueprint for. So I was gonna say, proteins. But in fact, this is actin, and you can see, and it's pretty obvious once you stop and think about it. It takes 3 nucleotides to code for a single amino acid, and nucleotides are about a factor of 3 larger than amino acids, done. And the same goes for, you know, size and so on. So there you go, that's that one. And then this one, the next one's kind of embarrassing, maybe for Edith. But who's more powerful on a per kilogram basis? Edith or the sun? And by what factor? Anybody? Well, you are the director general. So let's hope you're... No, anyway. So this is a fun one. So we each should be taking on... I'm an American, so, you know, I don't think most of us live by this, but we should be taking on 2,000 kcals per day. And that translates into roughly 10 to the 7th joules per day. There's 10 to the 5th seconds in a day, so 10 to the 7th joules divided by 10 to the 5th seconds leaves us with 100 watts. That's very typical, and if you work on one of those hotel exercise machines, you'll know. If you look at it, it's going to say your power output's like 200 watts. For the guys climbing Alpe d'Huez during the Tour de France, those guys can get up to more than 600 watts, doping or not. So that's very serious. So the output, power output of a human is 100 watts, and let's take my mass, which is more or less exactly 100 kilograms, so that's 1 watt per kilogram. And bacteria are a factor of about 1,000 or 10,000 higher than that. The sun, on the other hand, it's easy to calculate its power because we know there's 1,000 watts per square meter incident sunlight outside on a day like today. And I know the distance from the sun, so I can figure out the power of the sun. And there's the mass, and if you divide them, you'll find that the power of the sun is 10 to the minus 5 watts per kilogram. So the sun is way less powerful than Edith, which we all knew. All right. Okay, so that was mainly just to warm us up to my more environmental and ecological type questions. But the summary really is that Ron and I especially have been working very, very hard on trying to put together a curated database where you can really count on the numbers in the same way that engineers count on the numbers in traditional material settings. And it's not a trivial exercise. Just to give you an example, there's 2 very high profile papers that claim to measure the proteome of E. coli. And they get the same trends, in other words, they find the same relative values of different proteins, but they differ by a factor of 100. A factor of 100 on the absolute numbers. And I just want to say, you know, we live in this era where people are discovering exoplanets. And to discover exoplanets, one needs to actually have reliable measurements. Why? Well, the original exoplanets were discovered because of basically the fact that a star and its attendant planet, they're actually both moving around their common center of mass. That means the star is actually moving in a small elliptical orbit of its own, and it means part of the time the star is coming towards us and part of the time it's going away from us. That leads to a very small shift, which is analogous to the shift we hear when we listen to the funny sounding European ambulances, at least funny to the American ear, the Doppler effect. It's a 1 in 10 to the 6th effect. So if one wants to discover subtleties, the measurements have to be solid. And I'm just saying, when people disagree by a factor of 100 on the number of proteins in E. coli, for a person like me, that's not satisfactory. Okay, so now I turn to the more serious part of my exam. So where is the most biomass harbored? How many think it's arthropods? How many think it's bacteria? Not that many. Viruses? And what about plants? All right. Okay. Well, so, you know, there was a famous interaction between Haldane and somebody who asked him his views about religion, and they were trying to reconcile religion and evolution, and Haldane was said to have remarked, God has an inordinate fondness for beetles. To a first approximation, all multicellular species on Earth are insects, most eukaryotic organisms are arthropods, but that does not translate into biomass. So here is basically our best estimate of the situation. I should really say Yinon's best estimate of the situation with respect to biomass. And once again, like on plants, it's a fun exercise. If you're on a train sometime and you want to just try and make an estimate, try to figure out how many gigatons of carbon are associated with trees. And you'll probably succeed modestly well. You'll realize that it's very large. So the first time Ron and I talked about this, I said, well, you know, I don't really want to talk about the trunks and the stems and stuff. And even if you get rid of that, it's still the dominant player is plants. Okay, next one. Most prokaryotic biomass is land, ocean, or ocean subsurface. And when I say ocean subsurface, I'm talking about the sediment and the mud. I'm not talking about underwater. I'm talking about actually in the mud underneath the ocean. So who thinks it's land? How about ocean? Ocean subsurface. Okay. So this one's very interesting, and this is actually related to this. That was a great talk this morning. Thank you. I loved it so much. So, you know, people are doing these careful transects and going out and making measurements, and they're drilling cores and so on. I just love this graph on the left. It comes from a not that long ago of a paper where, you know, if you look at the x-axis, it's depth below the seafloor, and then the y-axis is cell concentration and cells per ml. And I just remind you that if you have a saturated culture at OD1, it's probably something like 10 to the 9th per ml. And in our guts, it might be something like 10 to the 10th per ml. So you can see, you know, that there's a lot of cells that are in the sediment. And so here is the upshot. So check out the two Voronoi diagrams. The one on the left is all prokaryotes. The one on the right is only it omits the deep subsurface. So you can see 5/6 of the bacteria are in the ocean subsurface. Okay, what is the overall mass ratio between prokaryotes and viruses? So 100-fold more bacteria? Anyone? Okay, 1-to-1. And 100-fold more viruses. Okay, so the rough numbers, first of all, there's a concept that's known as the VBR, the virus to bacterium ratio. That's of order 10. That means for every bacterium on planet Earth, there are roughly 10 viruses. I'd be curious to hear whether you guys confirm that, but there's some interesting recent papers that, you know, did flow cytometry and stuff. So that's our answer, actually. We already know the answer once I tell you that because of the size of viruses. There's roughly 10 to the 31st viruses on planet Earth and maybe 10 to the 30th bacteria. And here's the calculation. So there's a volume factor of 1 in 10,000 because of the 50 nanometer to the 1 micron scale. The abundance is tenfold more viruses, and the biomass thus has bacteria at around 100 to 1. And you can see that here. So you can see the viruses are a really little tiny part of the overall global biomass. Okay, what are the most abundant biomass animals? So we can try again. How many think it's arthropods? How many think it's fish? And what about nematodes? Okay, it's getting late in the afternoon. So here's the upshot on this one. So you can see in the lower right of the first diagram, that's the animals. And then on the left, that gives you the relative masses of fish and arthropods and stuff. And again, it'd be super fun to talk to you, but I think these fish are small. These are not big fish, but, you know, again, maybe we'll have a chance to chat about that at some point. I don't know, I'll skip this, although this is amusing just to understand the connection between number of individuals and biomass. This is maybe my favorite one. I've been spending a lot of time on this one lately. Number of livestock on Earth, specifically mass of cows relative to humans. So this is another one to do on the train. In other words, if you sit there and you think a little bit, you will be able to figure this one out. So 10 to 1, 4 to 1, 1 to 1. So here's the result. So in the middle is humans, and on the left, that's our cattle. And you know, you can see pigs and sheep and so on. And here's my little attempt to make an estimate. So first of all, on number one, the mass of a cow. So there's a very great trick for making estimates. If you don't know the size of something, you can come from below and pick a lower bound, come from above and pick an upper bound, multiply them together and take the square root. That's really finding the midpoint on a log scale. That's what that amounts to. So I couldn't, you know, I knew it was more than 100 kilograms and less than a few thousand, and so you get the mass of a cow is around 500 kilograms. The beef consumed per year, 7 times 10 to the 9th people. I assumed that roughly half of humans eat a meat diet, especially because we have China on the loose. And it turns out that the second only to Brazil, there's more cows in India than any other country in the world. That one surprised me. So if I imagine everybody eats 1 kilogram of beef per week, there's a few times 10 to the ninth people, that gives you 150 times 10 to the ninth kilograms. So the number of cows slaughtered per year should be around 300 million. And if you look it up, you'll find that that's more or less right. I didn't look it up, but I just calculated it. And then the number of cows in steady state, I think I made a mistake here because I don't think the residence time is 5 years anymore. I think it's shorter than that. But that tells you there should be around 500 million cows, and you can see the data actually over there, which is around 1,000 million cows on planet Earth. This is fascinating, which is to try to understand what's been going on over time. So this, the red thing on the left is the 100,000 years ago, and the bar graph on the right, this is the y-axis is gigatons of carbon, and you can see that our livestock is really quite dominant. So I just got back from the Aleutian Islands. It's one of my favorite places to go, and one of the reasons I go there is actually because of this issue of biodiversity and because of the work of James Estes and the loss of sea otters. That's the reason that I like to, I surf there, but anyway, I go there and I really, really enjoy watching. So in the early 20th century, it's very interesting. So, you know, if as an American, I learned about the gold rush, both in the Klondike and also in California. But in fact, there was a bigger gold rush in Alaska. And the gold rush was the result of Bering, who was the first person who went from Russia. He was a Danish explorer, and he went with Georg Steller. And what they discovered was otters. And so that is the gold of furs. And so over a 100-year period, especially the Russians, they basically decimated the population to the point of near extinction. And then the population of otters came back up to around 80,000 or 100,000 otters. I don't remember the numbers. And what Estes noticed is that sometime around 1990, the otter population started to decline again. And it's very interesting, and I love this comment from him. He says, the most dramatic moment of learning in my life happened in less than a second, and that was sticking my head in the water. Because what he did is he went to an island in the Aleutians that was protected, where there were otters, and there was lots of kelp. I don't know the word for kelp en français. Does anyone know? Kelp? That was pretty uninspiring, but okay. And then there, where the otters were absent, what he found was sea urchin barrens. So basically all you see, as you see on the right, is sea urchins. And so the bottom line is that otters are a keystone species in the sense that they eat kelp. They eat urchins, and they basically maintain the population of urchins. And in the absence of otters, basically the population collapses. And so this led to this very interesting hypothesis, which is that there was a fourth layer in the trophic cascade. And what you see here is the skull of an orca, or a killer whale. And it takes... basically, what happened is that as a result of whaling between 1950 and 1980 or 75 or something, the Russians and the Japanese killed more than 2 million whales. And the whales actually are the mammalian diet of killer whales, it turns out. And so it takes a very small shift One orca requires a minimum of 5 otters per day to survive. And, you know, to go back to the kinds of models we just heard about, you can quickly see what will happen to the sea otter population, and also the stellar sea lions, and so on. So there's a very interesting paper, sequential megafaunal collapse in the North Pacific Ocean. What is the relative mass of livestock birds to wild birds? 70% of birds on planet Earth are things that we eat. I don't know if this is that interesting. It's just people have a lot of preconceptions about this one, so maybe I'll ask it. What is the most abundant protein on Earth? Actin, Rubisco, phosphofructokinase, or histones? Most people, most biochemistry books will say it's Rubisco. And to the best of our knowledge, it's actually histones. Okay, this was the reason for my whole talk, the last question. When or if will the anthropomass pass the biomass? When I say anthropomass, I mean the stuff we make, in a particular asphalt, cement, plastic, metals, and even this wood if you want to include it, but it doesn't matter. It's not the key player. This is what I think people should think about a little bit. So I'm just asking. I've told you that there's basically 1,000 gigatons of biomass on planet Earth. And the question is, when will human production equal that amount? The answer is it's already happened. We already passed that. Which I find fascinating because it gives a new spin, a new quantitative spin on the notion of Anthropocene. So, you know, the data by categories is this. And here's another example of a very fun estimate. So I teach a weird class at Caltech where each year we try to find the 5 or so best freshmen in physics. And they have a 2-month long exam where they're given a couple of problems. And then we pick 4 or 5 of them. And we meet twice a week, or sorry, for 2 hours a week. And one day they came and I told them, I said, I want you guys to try and figure out what the anthropomass is on Earth. And so I said, I'm going to leave you for 20 minutes. And I kind of walked by and watched them, and they were doing calculations on a whiteboard, and I came back, and they had it to within less than a factor of 10. And the way they did it was very simple, and you could do it right here in Paris, too. They just looked at the Caltech campus. They tried to estimate the mass of our buildings. They figured out how many people fit in the square block that is our campus, and they multiplied by how many people there are, multiplied by the population of humans, and that more or less will work. So, you know, this—I already mentioned this at the beginning, but I just wanted to say, you know, as somebody who spent a lot of time out in the ocean on boats, that this is really the world as we have it now. You know, when I swim with penguins in the Galapagos, it's very odd because often I'll be there with all my students; they're super excited to be seeing penguins at the equator, but then we'll be sort of swimming around, and there will be everything from plastic bottle parts to women's menstrual device, you know, just everything all scattered around, just flowing there in the Humboldt current. You know, this paper has lots of data, and the numbers are kind of shocking. So just a few concluding thoughts then. So I guess the first thing I would say is that I'm intrigued by this idea, and I think it's espoused very well by Bill Gates, of trying to be data driven, and numbers should shape policy. So, you know, I don't know if Bill Gates is a dirty word anymore. He certainly was 20 years ago, but personally, I think that that's way out of line. The guy is really quite impressive and trying hard to do useful things. And these two books give examples. And, you know, as an American listening to a pretty out of control president, and I'm not saying that as I'm not a political person at all, but, you know, I remember when Trump was talking about our travel ban, and I happened to be in Canada, and they were showing the number of snowmobile accident deaths that month in Ontario. And I did a little calculation, and the number of people that have died from snowmobiling in Canada or in Michigan over the last 20 years is more than have died from terrorism. You know, it's just a very interesting thing. And so, like, if you look at number 10, that's the one that blows my mind. Number 10, intentional self-harm, suicide, 44,965 Americans every year. That's one Vietnam War worth of people killing themselves every year in the United States. The number of people that die from car accidents is a little bit below that. The number of people that die from falling You know, and I'm aware of that as I get older, just by falling. It's 30,000 people, you know? So these kinds of numbers can be enlightening. So Ron and I have worked very hard on trying to put together numbers that relate to molecular and cell biology. Here's kind of a little gallery of these things. And I guess where I'm really excited to move next is trying to understand the numbers that are associated with the great human experiment. So, you know, we had this little part in our paper, the impact of humanity on the biosphere, and I just feel that there's so many interesting things to do from the point of view of the by-the-numbers mindset with respect to the topics that we've talked about today. So, just one last thought. It's a very powerful thing in physics is the use of dimensionless numbers. For example, you know, upper left, we have the Reynolds number. That's used by, even the Wright brothers used the Reynolds number. They made a little small copy of their plane. And so these dimensionless numbers help us understand systems in a very useful way. And I think that the ecological and the human experiment aspects can be parameterized by interesting dimensionless numbers. I'm not going to comment on that. So anyway, this is the gang that I've worked with on this stuff. So Ron Milo, and then over on the left is Yane Kondev and Hernan Garcia, Julie Terrio and Christina Hishin, and then our artist who Toma also works with is Nigel Horn. So thanks again for having me here. I really appreciate it.